U.S. v. Stewart. Counsel for the appellant, please.
May it please the court, Major Jeff Liebman for the appellant, Captain Nicholas Stewart. With the court's permission, I can reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Can I ask one question? Can the folks in the back hear us? Because we were having trouble with that yesterday. You're good. Okay, thank you very much. Please carry on.
As to the first issue, because of the Prather legal impossibility principle, when the military judge found that Captain Stewart proved preponderance, or proved consent by preponderance of the evidence, he effectively found Captain Stewart not guilty. He just didn't know it because he didn't have the benefit of Prather yet. Had he had the benefit of Prather, he would have recognized that his preponderance ruling made it impossible for the government to disprove the affirmative defense beyond a reasonable doubt, and therefore, under RCM 917, a not guilty finding was required.
What specifically did the judge find? Did he say it was proven? Did it say there was some evidence? What specific words did he use? And where do they appear on the record?
Well, the specific words he used, Your Honor, he said, first of all, it's very clear that he's using the statute, and the statute uses proof. He actually, I point to JA at, starting at JA 26, where it says that the defense has the burden of meeting this preponderance standard. He uses the word show and establish in terms of what they did. That is, he never says they proved it, but I think it's absolutely clear from the record that he's using the standard from the statute, he's applying it, and what his finding essentially is that they proved the defense of consent by preponderance of the evidence.
How do you address the government's argument that there's no evidence yet admitted at that point at the 39A session?
Well, there is evidence, Your Honor. As a matter of fact, the military judge takes evidence from both the defense and the government. The defense puts in the 32 transcript, and they put in the NCIS statement. And they do it over after they object to the entire procedure and to the burden shift, but they nonetheless put that evidence in, and then the government puts in...
For the purposes of the 39A?
Well, for the purposes of establishing whether they've met their burden of preponderance to get this consent defense.
No, for the purposes of whether he ought to give the instruction. It's the member's case. He's not the trier of fact.
Actually, first, we would disagree, Your Honor, for two reasons. First, under RCM 917, the military judge is always going to be a finder of fact in a member's trial. He always has to, at least internally.
Well, and 917 contemplates the introduction of evidence on the merits and a subsequent decision that all the evidence on the merits having been in, the defense is entitled to a dismissal.
Agreed.
That's not the case here.
No, the case here, Your Honor, is over defense objection. The military judge applied the statute in this trial framework, which we simply have never seen before.
Leaving aside the weirdness of the trial.
It's a critical thing.
I agree. It's a 39A. It's not the admission of the evidence on the merits. So where do you get the 917 argument?
We find the 917A argument, Your Honor, in the fact that what the government wants this court to do is simply ignore the preponderance ruling here.
No, they got their instruction. That was the whole purpose of the 39A.
We can't divorce the fact that these are very separate and distinct parts of what happened here. First, the military judge is applying the statute. He says they have to show by a preponderance of the evidence that consent exists. That's a factual determination. And then, if they meet that factual determination as a matter of law, they will then get the instruction. Just like in a normal trial, where the evidence is presented, the defense moves for an affirmative defense instruction, the military judge makes a determination as whether or not there's enough factual evidence to support it. If there is, then he has to, as a matter of law, give the instruction. We get that this was all in a preliminary stage of the trial.
But the judge, back to Judge Stuckey's question, the military judge does not have to be convinced by the greater weight or the preponderance of the evidence that the defense has been sufficiently raised to submit that question to the finders of fact. So ultimately, the finder of fact has to decide whether he's proved it by the greater weight.
And the military judge in this particular case, Your Honor, believed he was that person. He stripped it from the defense, or excuse me, from the member's purview. He believed that he was the person in the best position to make the preponderance determination. And then he doesn't even use the sum evidence standard to determine whether an instruction should be given. He applies the preponderance standard from the statute.
He gave the instruction, did he not?
He did give the instruction,
yes,
sir. Yeah.
Okay, so why does the fact that he gave the instruction after applying the wrong standard, if that's what you're saying?
Well, what he did was...
Why does that prejudice the appellant?
Well, we're not in this particular issue, Your Honor, for starting the first one, we're not talking about prejudice. What we're talking about is Prather, where this court said, once you have this preponderance finding, it's a legal impossibility to beat this proof, and a not guilty finding must be entered. Now, that's effectively what happened here, unless this court simply ignores the preponderance ruling or says that the preponderance ruling somehow meant something different here, despite the fact that at every stage of this procedure, the defense objected. And then when they do put their evidence in, well, I'll get to that in the third issue, it never gets it from the members. But the crux of our argument here is, and we recognize that this is a case of first impression, but it was the military judge that set up this trial framework. It was a military judge that applied the statute in the manner in which he did. It was a military judge that made the preponderance ruling. The only way for this court to find that he shouldn't have entered not guilty finding from our perspective is to simply ignore that or say that it meant something different when it was clear that he believed under the statute it was his duty to make this finding.
Let me go back to the Chief Judge's question. And where in the record does he make this? I thought it was at page 192, which would be page 34 of the JA. But you say it's
the preponderance.
You say it's somewhere else.
Well, on page 126 of the JA, he first tells the defense, look, the statute puts this burden on you to show it. Then on page 27, he starts talking about how he believes it's a mixed question of fact or law to make the preponderance determination, and that he believes he was in the best position to actually make the determination. On 28, the defense then objects to the whole procedure. They object to the burden shift. And then the military judge says, well, we're going this way. Do you have any evidence? He presents the evidence, and then the military judge talks about how he hasn't even read the 32 transcript, only the NCIS statement. That's the only thing it's based on.
But let's look at the precise words.
You're saying on 192, Your Honor, yes.
The precise word, he says, I'm convinced that the defense has met their burden with regards to asserting the defense, not that they've met their burden to prove the defense.
True, Your Honor, but I think we're really splitting hairs here, and we take it out of context if we simply say that, well, that he didn't find what we claim he found. He was clearly applying the statute from the get-go. He was clearly telling the government or the defense that they had a preponderance burden to meet. And then he made the preponderance ruling.
This language on page 192 is classic trial judge language, is it not?
Yes, Your Honor.
But it's also
classic if he had used the sum evidence standard, which is the proper one, but he thought that was the wrong standard based on the statute. So we can't divorce, even if the military judge, which we disagree with, was simply making a determination as whether the instruction should be given, they cannot be divorced from the fact that determining whether he's met the preponderance burden and whether the instruction are the same thing based on the context of this case and the way the military judge set the trial framework up.
Isn't your best argument here that what the judge did, including this instruction, which the court seems to have blessed a similar instruction in Medina, but isn't this instruction the one that Judge Erdman speaks about?
Yes, Your Honor.
He can't conceive of how you could cure this burden-shifting problem.
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't that really the problem in this case, that he didn't give an instruction to the members that would have cured that?
We don't disagree with that, Your Honor. We agree. We just haven't briefed that and really talked about it much. So, I mean, we could cite or put something in supplemental on that to explore it more. We actually supped six different issues in this court, and it granted out three. So I think there's more problems in this case than just what we're talking about.
Yeah, but those grants came before.
Agree, Your Honor. But we agree that, as the government pointed out in its brief, and the judge is in a rock and a hard place here. If he instructs according to statute, it's error. If he doesn't, it's error. So there's error no matter what he does. He just, and we, you know, we're not here to disparage the judge. I mean, he struggled with a very problematic statute that nobody knew how to apply. He did it the way that he thought was best. And now we're here. And I think there's a big problem for Captain Stewart in a way that was applied. And that a not guilty finding was required, and this court just shouldn't ignore this preponderance ruling he made. I'd like to move to the second issue.
Let me ask one more question.
Yes, Your Honor.
At the end of all of the evidence, could he have then, upon proper motion, directed a verdict of not guilty because the defense had proved its defense by a preponderance of the evidence?
Can you repeat that, Your Honor?
Is there a procedure in the military court-martial where at the end of all of the evidence, the defense could say, Your Honor, I move dismissal of these charges or finding him not guilty because the accused has met his burden of proof of consent or mistake of fact by a preponderance of the evidence, just like you said back in the 39A say?
The defense could have done that, Your Honor, yes.
I mean, but they didn't.
No, sir. As to the second issue really revolves around the lower court's inability to conduct its Article 66 review. That is, because the members found Captain Stewart not guilty of the first specification, but
let's take a look at that, if we could. Mm-hmm. If you take a look at the findings worksheet, was in fact there a finding of not guilty, or was there just no finding at all?
Well, there
wasn't anything announced there, so how do you get to that?
Well, we get the first, we point out that in the results of the record of trial from the trial counsel to the general court martial convening authority, it says, as to the first specification, not guilty, as to the second, guilty. But more importantly, the way the judge instructed was that if you vote on the specification, if you find him not guilty, you then move to the second one. There's only two specs here. The second, the military judge instructed on one and two in that order. And so, yes, we agree that they did not circle not guilty, but they were instructed that they could only find him guilty of one. So the fact that they just crossed it out, just like in a Walter, a classic Walters type issue, there's at least an implied not guilty finding, because we presume that the members followed the military judge's instructions. They voted on the first one and then the second one. And they believe that the second one is the guilty, and they find him
but
not guilty.
Did he not instruct them that they had to pick one or the other? He couldn't be guilty of both because of the manner in which he had defined the terms?
He did, Your Honor. And
so if you presume they followed his instructions, aren't you?
Well, if we start to get into that argument, which we recognize, Your Honor, then we're right back into Walters, which is this court just doesn't know what they did. Which instruction did they follow? And so we have a classic ambiguity from Walters. In either way, the danger, we either have an actual danger it actually happened that they find him not guilty of the first and guilty of the second, or we just don't know.
When you stack these up next to each other, isn't one really an LIO or the other using the elements test? In one, you've got to be incapable of anything. In the other one, you've got to be incapable of consenting to sex. Isn't two basically an LIO of one?
No, Your Honor, not the way the military judge. Maybe that's what Congress intended, but the military judge.
I'm not purporting to say what Congress intended, but it seems like if you stack these up next to each other and just apply the elements test, one's an LIO or the other.
Actually, we hadn't considered that, Your Honor, but what we will say is that the military judge's instructions were identical to those two particular elements. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, the member's ultimate conclusion was based on two specifications that had zero difference. And as a result, we're in this, it's not a classic Walters issue, which why we really rely on the principle of United States versus Smith.
Is this really a Walters situation, or is it something more fundamental?
It's more fundamental in terms of, it's really, we have this constitutional issue with double jeopardy, Your Honor. It's really Smith. The lower court cannot find as fact any allegation which the accused is found not guilty of at trial.
Does your argument boil down to the fact that a trial that members cannot find an individual guilty of an offense and also find the individual not guilty of the same offense?
It really does, Your Honor. And, you know, we've gone a little bit different way here because that was our second supplemented issue, which is because these were duplicative, you had this double jeopardy issue. But the court didn't grant on that, so we thought we were just going more towards this Walter Smith type of issue. But at the heart of it has always been this constitutional...
But is that really a double jeopardy issue?
It is, Your Honor, when you have two duplicative specifications given to the members, and they find him guilty and not guilty. Once they find him not guilty of the first specification, you're done. I mean, there's nothing, they shouldn't be allowed to vote on the second. So at every stage of this trial, it shouldn't have been allowed there. It shouldn't have been allowed on review. The lower court should recognize it and now it's before this court.
Your case seems to hinge on whether he was acquitted of the first. What is your strongest argument in that regards, and what is your weakest? What is your weakest?
Well, the strongest argument, Your Honor, is the instruction from the military judge, where he says you vote on the specification, then you vote on the second one. Now, under those circumstances, clearly they find him not guilty of the first, because they don't find him guilty. If they had, they would have stopped.
Okay, I understand that is your best argument. How do you address the findings worksheet itself, where acquittal is struck out rather than circled?
Well, I think that the other instructions the judge gives is you can only find him guilty of one. And if you find him guilty of one, after you're done, if you find him guilty or not guilty, whatever you find, cross out everything that is not applicable. And so you see the LIOs crossed out, you see the not guilty aspect in the first section crossed out, so you see all of this. But recognizing that argument that's out there, Your Honor, in terms of what they actually did, then we're just right back into your classical Walters type of issue, in that we don't really know what they did. And because we don't know what they did, we can't go back and review it, because we have this double jeopardy problem where they're reviewing something they acquitted of. The military judge, if we do see this ambiguity, then he should have clarified it at the trial stage. I see I'm short on time. If there's no question of that, I can go to the third issue, and we'd really just jump into the prejudice analysis, Your Honor. The crux of our third issue is the military judge committed prejudicial error by requiring Captain Stewart to present this evidence with the members absent. And the crux of this argument is that the military judge gives this instruction, and he does not give the evidence to the members that it's based on. And
so, well, isn't that the responsibility of the defense attorney to make sure that that evidence is admitted?
No, Your Honor. It's the responsibility of the military judge to ensure that the accused gets a fair trial. And it's not in the briefs, I wish I had put in there, but it's important, you know, I think, for us to remember that if this was a classic trial, once the evidence was all presented, if the evidence raised an affirmative defense, the military judge would have a sua sponte duty to instruct on that defense, regardless of if the defense asked for it or not. Well, here it's flip-flop. Here we have the judge giving the instructions but not giving him the evidence. And as a result, if he does that, the rule should be flip-flop. But
here I thought the defense attorney during the 39A session recognized his responsibility to get that evidence into the record on the merits.
Yes, Your Honor.
And he didn't do it.
Well, there's nothing in the manual, and the government actually cites none, that requires a defense counsel to publish, to stand up and say, Your Honor, we'd now like to publish the evidence to the members.
But they do have a responsibility to get evidence in the record that they want to rely on.
Yes, Your Honor.
In support of their case.
And
counsel, are you, you're out of time, but yes, you certainly can answer Judge Erdman's question if you'd like. But
Your Honor,
no extra
recognize
stuff.
It. We would have liked the defense counsel to be more clear on whether he thought this was in or it was not. But at the end of the day, it's just inescapable that where the military judge says, I'm going to give an instruction based on this evidence, he gives the instruction and he doesn't give them the evidence. And, you know, we talk a lot about the 32 transcript, but his preponderance ruling wasn't based on that at all. It was solely on Captain Stewart's statement. And the heart of the prejudice analysis here, this court has the luxury that it usually doesn't have. It knows what a reasonable person would have thought about this case with the statement, which is Colonel Bowers of Iowa.
So, thank you, counsel. You have your rebuttal shot as well. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Baker, may it please the court. Addressing the first and third Brandon issues, the military judge's interlocutory ruling in this case that consent was an issue and thus that instruction need be given should not result in a directed verdict for the accused. Second, any error that resulted from that procedure or from the appellant's due process argument is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Regarding the Walters issue, Your Honors, first of all, Walters clearly does not apply because the specification does not allege on diverse occasions. Second, the instructions foreclose the members from convicting on both specifications. They were abundantly clear that you can only convict on either specification or neither specification. Finally, appellant invited the Walters error. Turning back to the first and third issues, Your Honors, and there's certainly overlap between the two. As this court has stated, evidence that goes to an affirmative defense can be raised at any point in the trial. So perhaps that is the problem in the procedure. And the judge was clear, you have to raise this evidence now. And that contradicts DPL, where this court says the government, through its own evidence or through the defense evidence, can get over the hurdle for an affirmative defense instruction. But that aside, there's no prejudice in this case because the defense knew going into the trial, as soon as he made his opening statement, or he didn't actually make an opening statement, but the government made his opening statement, the defense knew exactly what the goalpost of this trial was. And that was that consent was an issue, and the mistake of fact, the consent was an issue. And he knows that based on a pretrial hearing. But they couch it in other ways, but what they're asking for is a directed verdict. They're asking for the judge, and it's sort of confusing because they're asking for this even pre-trial, and that the judge simply does not have the power to acquit. It doesn't even matter what standard the judge used. It cannot result in an acquittal before members are sat, before evidence is received. A couple things briefly about the first and third issue. At page 14 of the record, I'm sorry, page 14 of the JA, this is a hearing before the hearing about consent. The Civilian Defense Council talks about how consent and mistake of fact of consent are at issue in this case. So there can be no argument that this hearing kind of let the cat out of the bag here. It was a consent defense. And we knew this before we even had the hearing about the affirmative defense instruction. The government knew it from the Defense Council's own words. If there are no questions on the first issue, Your Honors, the government will address.
Is there any requirement in the rules for courts-martial that a defendant give notice of an affirmative defense?
Not about consent, Your Honor.
Alibi, some of those, lack of mental responsibility. There are some you have to give notice, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
This is not one of them.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
A couple things about the Walters issue. First of all, Congress, via the text of Article 120, separates these two possibilities. So they're not identical. Certainly there's overlap between the two, but it's crucial that they are not identical.
But they're defined as identical here.
They are, Your Honor.
So for purposes of this case, to the members, they're two identical offenses.
We would respectfully disagree with that point, Your Honor, and we do so based on the wording of the specification, which is provided for the members in the instructions, as well as the elements of the offenses, which there you did have a slight difference between substantially incapacitated and substantially incapable of declining participation in the charged act. And it is this, again, which, although very similar, the definition should not trump Congress's intent for the text of their statute, which the judge did instruct properly on, that, hey, here are the elements of the offense based on the text of Article 120.
Well, what are they supposed to do with the definitions that the military judge gave them?
Well, I think they're supposed to consider them, Your Honor, but I don't think that it necessarily means you then forget about the elements of the offense as you're instructed, or even, frankly, the wording of the specification. I think there are, I mean, obviously a host of possibilities where somebody can be substantially incapacitated, and yet they might meet one and not the other. I think as the court discussed earlier, maybe one could be an LIO of another.
Well, I think we're all in agreement that there's probably a difference between the two as they're stated, but the problem here is that they were defined to be the same thing for whatever reason.
Right, and that's how the bench book defines it, Your Honor. I don't think that controls this case for a number of reasons. I mean, first, the best argument for the government clearly is the instruction. They were told you can't convict on both. And that, if you actually look at page 83 of the joint appendix, it makes perfect sense. When the president announces findings, he says, of the charge, alternative specification 2, guilty. And that's it. I mean, he doesn't say specification 1, not guilty, because they knew the second they went back there in the members' deliberation room, it was one or the other. In addition to that, this whole
what do you say the difference is?
I think for substantiating capacity, Your Honor, that would refer to somebody who's either drunk or as a result of some drugs, some chemical intoxicant, they're, you know, beyond the point where they could voluntarily consent to sexual activity. For the other possibility, for substantially incapable of declining participation, I think that can simply refer to somebody who cannot communicate, be it from a drug, be it from alcohol, be it from them being blindfolded, gagging. You could have a number of reasons. But again, I think it's when you actually look at the facts of this case, when you look at how this whole duplicitous issue and the whole thing about it, really even before the duplicitous issue came up, you had the defense's motion was to force the government to dismiss either alternative. And the reasoning was completely flawed. This court in Brown and in Vidal and the Supreme Court in a number of other cases says that the government can put a case to the members with two possibilities, with two separate statutory alternatives. That was the basis for this entire motion, was you can't allow the government to go there and say, well, it could be substantially incapacitated or it could be substantially incapable. And that's frankly incorrect. And that's how we get to the duplicitous argument. And what's even more problematic for the defense is the judge says, okay, fine, I'm going to give you the instruction you want. I'm going to tell the jury, you have to agree on which of the two possibilities it is. And that's directly in contradiction of this court's Brown holding. I mean, who knows why he did it? He bunged some caution. He says, okay, I'm going to give you what you want. And the defense says, no, we want to sever the specification. So we're only here talking about these two specifications because of the defense's own actions. And that, of course, is the government's argument for invited error. A couple of other brief points, Your Honors.
Could I ask, putting aside the whole instruction issue, which is hard to do, but pretend that it hasn't come up, and during the course of the trial, the military judge is convinced, as the trial judge with members, that in fact the defendant has proven consent in a beyond a reasonable doubt kind of way. Is he required, as the defense argues, to, under 917, to direct a verdict of not guilty then?
We don't think he is, Your Honor. We don't think he has that power. I mean, that's why we have Article 66 in the military, and it's because the courts of criminal appeal, though your directed verdict, or though the verdict goes against the weight of the evidence, I mean, obviously it exists for a number of other reasons, but the judge simply does not have the power, and that's the Griffith case from this court talks about that. How
would a military judge handle it if one of the essential elements was not proved?
Well, that's a key distinction, Your Honor. If there's no evidence on the essential element, certainly the judge must dismiss it under 917. If he believes that the great weight or the credibility of the evidence supports the defense, he's powerless. I mean, certainly he can perhaps give a recommendation to the committing authority about taking action on the findings or taking action on the sentence. But even if the government comes in, has somebody testify, and that person's credibility is completely eviscerated, that does not give the judge now the power to dismiss the case and say, I acquit you factually. So certainly there's a distinction between that and 917, which is legal error, which is, you know, a case of legal insufficiency. A couple of brief points to note, Your Honors. First, trial in this case occurred September 14th, 18th, 2009. That's, of course, before this court's Neal and Prather opinions, which give some of the reasoning or basis for the trial court's procedure in this case. Briefly want to address the Powell case from the Supreme Court in 1984. And there the court talks about when you have, in that case, an acquittal, the government, to be clear, does not concede that there's an acquittal here on specification 1. But when you have an acquittal and an inconsistent verdict, it doesn't necessarily mean that the jury was not convinced of the appellant's guilt. There can be a host of reasons for that. Can be jury lenity. It could have given them a break. And in this case, when they're only, again, instructed it's one or the other, that principle, we believe, should factor in this court's opinion. Finally, Your Honor, to address one of the questions that was raised at appellant's during appellant's argument, the judge's words on page 193 of the record, at the close of this pretrial hearing, was, you have your instruction. It was not, you have an acquittal, It was not the case is dismissed. You've proven consent. It was you have your instruction. The parties were clear during that hearing that that's all they were talking about, was whether a consent and a mistake of fact as to consent instruction should be given. Are there no further questions from the court?
What, on issue three.
Yes, sir.
What evidence was before the members that was also before the judge and was also before the Article 32 investigating officer?
The victim's testimony would be the primary piece of evidence, Your Honor. You also had the victim's brother testified as to some admissions that the accused made. I think that was crucial evidence that was before both the 32 and the finders of fact.
I just found it strange that the 32 officer, looking at his evidence, recommended it not go to a court-martial. The judge, looking at his evidence, said, you raised, by a preponderance of the evidence, a consent defense. Then the members don't look at that evidence, and they find him guilty.
Well, they didn't look at it, Your Honor, because nobody offered it. I mean, the civilian defense counsel...
I misunderstood the record. I thought that both the civilian defense counsel and the trial counsel were under the impression that it was in evidence.
We would respectfully disagree with that factual characterization of the evidence, Your Honor.
Wasn't Mr. Giddings actually arguing it, and somebody stopped him and said that never came into evidence, so he shifted his argument?
He argues that in closing. Well, Your Honor, he talks about a couple things. First of all, during the 917, the basis for the 917 motion is the government didn't prove penetration. The government didn't prove that sex occurred. And yet, here we are on appeal arguing that the civilian defense counsel didn't know the statement was an issue. Into evidence. But in the statement concedes that sex occurred. So you couldn't base your 917 motion on, hey, there's no evidence before the court that, you know, that element was proven. But then all of a sudden, now we're arguing the statement wasn't an issue. It just doesn't make any sense. Second, there were two other pieces of evidence. First, the appellant says to the victim, you know, are you on the pill? And he says that to her, and she testifies to this at trial, because he's concerned, obviously, about a possible pregnancy, which he would only be concerned about, of course, if the sex occurred. So there's clearly evidence in the record for which the government, for which the military judge could say, hey, this has to go back to the finder of fact on that element. I'm not in a situation where there's no evidence that I have to dismiss under 917. If there are no further questions from the court, that concludes the government's argument. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the appellant.
Your Honor, we're not asking for some kind of directed verdict here. Judge Cox's question says, when the military judge found the defense proved consent by preponderance, he necessarily was finding that the government could not prove incapacitation or substantially incapable. That's what this court said in Prather, that if you prove consent by preponderance, it's impossible to show substantially incapable or incapacitated. So this notion of a directed verdict simply doesn't work. And while we recognize that, yes, all of the evidence wasn't in, and the trial framework was certainly different than we've ever seen, this was all created by the military judge over objection to the defense, and the government should not now get to inure to the benefit of claiming that the judge erred in going in this route. The second, as to the Walters or Smith-type issue, there's simply no invited error here. The government really mischaracterized what happened. What the defense asked for was that the government choose one or the other. And yes, they were concerned about this majority, two-thirds majority concurrence on one or the other. But they also talked about he didn't feel like the military or the members would be able to follow their instruction. And imagine that if this had gone to the members in one spec with both of the substantially incapable and incapacitated in there, and then they were defined identically. It just doesn't make sense. And what the military judge said was, I'm going to tell them to pick one, or I'll sever it into two, and I'll instruct. And then if they find him guilty of both, I'll merge them. That's when the defense then decided, we'll sever them. But then the judge flip-flops his instruction and says, no, I'm not going to instruct that way. I'm going to tell them they have to choose one or the other. What the judge should have done was said, it's all or nothing. If he had done that, we're not even talking about this issue today. In the end, this court should rule in Captain Stewart's favor on either issue one and two, dismiss the charge of specification of prejudice.
Thank you, counsel. The court thanks both counsel for your arguments, and the case is submitted, and we will stand in recess until further order of the court.
Court is standing in recess.